Ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure to greet you this evening and to be together this evening. It's a great honor because we are very pleased to this evening welcome Ingrid Rimland, the wife of Ernst Sundel, to speak to us. Many, many more people are able to listen and see our speakers through the internet now and through recordings than was ever possible in the past. And that's why that beyond the number of people here this evening, I'm very pleased to see, many other people will be able to share this evening with us. I want to talk about several things during the relatively brief remarks that I'm going to make. I want to talk about Ernst Sundel, the man. I'm going to try to put his case in a little bit of context, and we'll take a break, and then I'll introduce our main speaker, Ingrid Rimland. It's an amazing thing that during the last 2 years, during which Ernst Sundel has been held in solitary confinement in Canada, he has become, in many ways, more important than he was in the years just before his arrest on February 5th, 2003. He had left Canada. He and Ingrid Rimland had married. They had made a home in Tennessee in the mountains. And in many ways, he had played down or closed down tremendously much of his activity, certainly in comparison to the beehive of activity that he was in charge in at the Sundel House in Toronto. On February 5th, 2003, everything changed. That morning, officials, local police officials, and immigration officials came and took him away. 2 weeks later, he was deported to Canada, and ever since then, he's been held in solitary confinement in the detention center near Toronto. During this last 2 years, Ernst Sundel has become a kind of rallying point for many, many people across the United States, in Canada, and around the world. The case of Ernst Sundel's incarceration, his arrest, is such an obvious and flagrant outrage, such an obvious violation of justice, that people, regardless of what they may think about what Ernst Sundel says and has said about the Holocaust or World War II or other issues, can very readily agree that the incarceration of Ernst Sundel is a tremendous violation of basic justice. This is a point I stress over and over, and it's sometimes uncomfortable to hear people say bad things about Ernst Sundel, even as they acknowledge that the treatment of him during the past 2 years has been as outrageous as it really is. Shortly after his arrest, the editor of the Hamilton Spectator newspaper in Canada, a man named Bill Dunphy, who had covered and written a lot about the so-called right-wing scene in Canada over the years, wrote at that time what was especially a very brave column talking about the Sundel case. This was in a column he wrote on May 14, 2003 in the Hamilton Spectator. Hamilton's a fairly important city in the province of Ontario. He says, "Our government has seized and branded Ernst Sundel, stripped him of his human rights, tried him in secret and found him wanting, and will now hand him over to a foreign government anxious to throw him in jail. Sundel, who did this country a favor by wiping off the books our disgraceful false news laws, has never once been convicted of a criminal offense in this country, never once found to have violated the hate crime laws that nest snugly around the throat of free expression in this country. Calculating correctly that there was no political cost, no downside to slipping on the jackboots to kick a reviled old man out of our country, our government cobbled together their best insults and innuendo, and Lord knows what secret evidence, and branded Ernst Sundel a threat to national security. I know this man, his local and international contacts, and I know this movement. And after reading the 58-page unclassified summary of the government's case, I can assure you there is no justice here. Their evidence is riddled with errors and misinformation, hearsay, and inflammatory innuendo. Dead men walk again, and the shattered bits of shoddy secret networks long since collapsed under the weight of their own ineptitude are made whole and menacing once again." It is a shameful piece of dishonest, unreliable tripe. Unquote. Even more remarkable, Canada's most prestigious daily newspaper, the Toronto Globe and Mail, it's something like the New York Times of Canada, has on two occasions published editorials reflecting the opinion, considered an opinion of this newspaper, denouncing the treatment of Aaron Sundell. In one editorial, dated March 6, 2004, the Toronto Globe and Mail said that Sundell is being held on a, quote, guilt by association pretext, and affirmed that he, in fact, poses no risk to people or property. Quote, he has never been charged with a violent crime and does not urge others to commit violence. The real danger to Canadians, the editorial concluded, comes not from individuals like Sundell, but from a government that casually discards our most precious rights. More recently, in another editorial, the Toronto Globe and Mail called Canada's treatment of Sundell, quote, an abuse of secret trial legislation, unquote. It went on, quote, what little evidence has emerged suggests the Crown is arguing not that he has incited violence, but that his material might be read by people who might incite violence. Guilt by association. The willingness of Canadian authorities to twist the narrow purpose of the security trial legislation to go after Aaron Sundell is a blot on Canadian justice. Unquote. There was a lot of talk in the last few weeks by the President of the United States about freedom. He did it in his inaugural speech, and he did it again in his State of the Union speech the other night. He talks a lot about freedom, but we are here this evening to reaffirm our commitment to freedom in a very concrete way. For Mr. Bush, the idea of American freedom might consist in the ability of Americans to watch the Jerry Springer show or debate whether homosexuals should be allowed to marry or not. But Aaron Sundell is in prison in a very concrete violation of freedom that is, as I said, so outrageous that even people who disagree with his views strongly, readily and forcefully say that this is a violation. Now, what is Canada's idea of freedom anyway? Just the other day, a friend in Canada circulated the most recent edition of the Canadian Customs Authority publication on banned books, books that are not permitted to be brought into Canada. And it has a long list divided into two basic sections, pornography and hate literature. Under hate literature, of all things, banned from Canada is this book, Setting the Record Straight, Letters from Cell Number 7 by political prisoner Aaron Sundell. It's a double outrage. Not only is this book not hate literature by any reasonable standard, but that the Canadian authorities would ban a book that consists of letters by a man who's being held under such outrageous circumstances is a double outrage. Now, the Canadian authorities may think that Canadians are not fit to make up their own minds about this booklet, which is, by the way, available from the IHR and from Ingrid Rimland in Tennessee. But the Canadian authorities do think that all sorts of interesting books entitled on incestuous relations in family, sexual relations in families, sexual relations with animals, those are permissible in Canada, a lot of other things as well. But this book, which by no reasonable standard could be termed subversive or hateful, is banned. This is exactly what the founding fathers of America had in mind that should be protected when they made the First Amendment of our Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights, protecting freedom of speech, has been construed in our country to protect all sorts of so-called speech that the Founding Fathers, by any stretch of the imagination, were not intending to protect. But what they did mean to protect, above all, was rational, reasoned arguments having to do with political and historical questions. Now, Aaron Sundell is best known, of course, for what he has written and said about the Holocaust issue. And that's why that's why he's in prison. The point that I make over and over, and I've done it on numerous interviews just recently, is that the most obvious proof that the Holocaust story is not and is not allowed to be looked at objectively in our society is the fact that in this country, but even more so in most European countries, it's a crime to dispute it. It's the only chapter of history that's protected judicially in this way, that to dispute the official or orthodox view of history can earn a person in Germany or France or Switzerland or Austria or the Netherlands a prison sentence, a fine, or other forms of oppression. That alone should show you where the real censors are and where the real enemies of freedom of speech are. Many of those who are here tonight and who are listening to my voice and the voice of Ingrid Rimland from this podium tonight have never met Ernst Sindel. And that's why I want to say a few words about him. Ernst Sindel is a colorful man. He does not claim to be a scholar. He calls himself an impresario, a man who arranges and facilitates. And Ernst Sindel is indeed a remarkable man. I first met him in 1988 when he asked me to come to Canada and talk with him with an eye toward possibly testifying in the second of the two great Holocaust trials in Canada. Ernst Sindel was tried in 1985 and again in 1988 under an archaic law against so-called false news in Canada, and this law was cited by a Jewish woman named Sabrina Citron in an effort to stop him from circulating a booklet, Did 6 Million Really Die? I met Ernst Sindel, not knowing much about him, except that I had heard he's a rather flamboyant character. But like just about everyone else I know, no matter what you may think about his ideas, Ernst Sindel is a very impressive man in person. I was, like many others, after meeting him, I was convinced this is a man who's sincere, who's not a nut, he's not a dangerous person, and he is sincerely interested in what is true and right, and his motives are good. I testified for 5 days in that trial. It was a very grueling experience, and it was a pretty jolting experience for me, and I testified several years later, in 1999, I think it was, and again in the year 2001, in the so-called Human Rights Tribunal hearing. And it was a very amazing experience. One of the things that was very impressive in 1988 was how Ernst had won the trust and the support of so many different people. Those of us who spent some time in these circles knows that people like us can often be very, very individualistic. And it's very hard to get people who are very individualistic to work together for a common cause and a common purpose. It's an immense tribute to Ernst Sindel that he was able to get people who are very, very diverse, very, very often prickly in their personalities, to work together in these very, very well-organized, very extensively organized legal cases that he had. From his house on Carlton Street, it was a three-story house with a basement. Ernst Sindel had almost all the time, day and night during the trials, people preparing things, photocopying, typing. I mean, it was a beehive of activity, very impressive. And what was most impressive was how Ernst Sindel made this all come together in the way it did. It's said that a man who gives cajoles and persuades others, a leader, must be a person who himself is able and willing to do the things that he asks others to do. And that was very true of Ernst. He would ask people to do all sorts of tasks, but Ernst himself was never reluctant to sweep, clean dishes, do the most mundane tasks. And he did so cheerfully. And it was very impressive to see how he got others to do to also help. Another thing that impressed me about Ernst at that time was his amazingly strong intuitive sense about people. I went through a process that, when it first happened to me, I thought was unique, but I found out that I was being given the treatment that everybody did who came to visit him and was being considered as a possible witness. Ernst would be very friendly, welcome me or whoever it happened to be, and then he would ask them to come upstairs to the dining room, which is right off the kitchen, on the third floor. And he'd sit down and he'd offer tea or coffee or whatever anybody wanted, and he'd have a talk. But it was really a kind of interrogation. Ernst was really sizing people up, sizing them up for suitability as a possible witness. Or in other cases, if there was some other task that he wanted them to do or some other way they could be helpful. And I was really amazed at Ernst's ability to size up people. Now, I'm not saying that just for me, but for others, because sometimes people came away very unhappy because Ernst decided for one reason or another that it wouldn't be good for them to be useful in the trial in a public way. I remember one case in particular that was very touching to me. One of his witnesses was an elderly Jewish man named Joseph Berg, or Joseph Ginsburg. He's now dead. He had been living in Germany. He was pretty elderly and frail and pretty crotchety. And Ernst decided that he was to testify in the trial. But this man was so crotchety, he needed a lot of careful hand-holding. And Ernst devoted a tremendous amount of time to trying to make this man feel comfortable, to reassure him, to guide him along and to help him every step of the way in this trial. And he testified. It's hard to know how useful his testimony was. But I was very impressed by the patience that Ernst had with this man, who, in fact, repaid his all of Ernst's efforts later by denouncing Ernst as a CIA agent, of all things. But anyway, that's another story. Because, it's oftentimes these things happen. And throughout the whole of that trial, and throughout the years I've known Ernst, I've been very impressed by his extraordinary patience and forbearance dealing with people, and the kind of philosophical attitude on the one hand, but at the same time, his determination to act forcefully, to take action whenever it was required and necessary. One of the points that Ingrid has made about Ernst Zundel that's very true is she's emphasized in her newsletters and on other occasions, this is a man, ecce homo, as they say in Latin. A very remarkable man, and it's a tribute to him that tomorrow and this weekend, people will be meeting outside of Canadian consulates and embassies and diplomatic places, not only in downtown Los Angeles, but also in Washington, D.C., Seattle, Boston, Atlanta, San Francisco, perhaps I've left out some other places. And it's a remarkable thing that people are rallying together for freedom for this man. Now, one of the things that's a particular outrage is how little, apart from the few voices and some of the voices I've quoted here tonight, the so-called defenders of freedom have ignored this case. Amnesty International should be ashamed at itself for its refusal to take up Ernst Zundel's cause. The double standard of Amnesty International is reflected not only in the Ernst Zundel case, but in the way that for some time, years before, they defended Nelson Mandela. Now, the impression has been given by many people that Nelson Mandela was held in prison in South Africa for many years as a political prisoner. It's not true. He was, in fact, found guilty of involvement in terrorism acts of terrorism. And Amnesty International had to go through all sorts of hoops and explanations to excuse the fact that it was defending a man who was in prison not for peaceful expression of views, but in fact for illegal, for murderous activities. But even though Amnesty International would take up the cause of Nelson Mandela, it's very politically correct to do so, it has refused to take up the cause of Ernst Zundel, even though the injustice in this case is as blatant and as obvious as it is. I want to encourage those here this evening to yourself and to tell others as well about the demonstration that we'll be having tomorrow at noon outside the Canadian Consulate in downtown Los Angeles. There's information about that posted on our website. It should be an interesting occasion because the Jewish Defense League, a militant Zionist organization with a very long and criminal record, has announced that they will be there also to oppose our demonstration. The police have been notified. I've talked with the police yesterday and today. and they assure me that the situation is will be well in hand and under control. So I'm hoping that it'll have just enough to make it an interesting occasion without being dangerous or violent or harmful for anyone. Anyway, I want to encourage everyone about that as well. I have just a few minutes left, and I want to use this opportunity to answer any questions that anyone may have about Aaron Sindel or about other aspects that I may shed light on before we take a break and go to our next speaker. Yes?
Well, we don't have access to the Internet right now, so where is that?
The Canadian consulate is at 550 South Hope Street, near 6th and Flower Streets, just beside the library, the main library in downtown Los Angeles. It's in a multi-story building, and we'll be outside in front of that. We held a similar demonstration in May of 2003, not long after Ernst was taken to Canada, and it was very peaceful and went without any incident, and we hope the one tomorrow will be just as peaceful.
I thought the JDL had been labeled, and rightfully so, a terrorist organization and illegal. Is that true?
In America, organizations aren't illegal. Individual activities are illegal, and people who carry out illegal acts can be arrested. But the organization in America, organizations are not made illegal. The former head of the JDL for many years, Irv Rubin, was arrested along with his colleague, a man named Kugler, for attempting to blow up a mosque and the office of Daryl Issa, a U.S. congressman. I always like to say the JDL is proof that not all Jews are of exceptional intelligence. Erev Rubin claimed that he wanted to blow up the congressman's office to give the Arabs in Southern California a wake-up call in the aftermath of 9/11. Well, the Arabs in Southern California were afraid they were going to be rounded up themselves. Daryl Issa has no particular record of going to bat for Arab causes particularly, but he is of Lebanese Arab descent. In any case, going after a U.S. congressman's office in the aftermath of 9/11 is not a very smart move, and he was arrested. And I think it was probably the prospect that he would have to face evidence from his colleague against him that finally made Irv Rubin decide to kill himself. Now, his wife claims he was murdered in prison. I think he was probably took his own life. He's not a very stable guy under the best of circumstances. One thing that came out in the aftermath of his arrest was a particular interest to me. In the investigation of Irv Rubin, police agent with a wire was talking with Krugel, his colleague, and he admitted that the arson attack firebombing against the IHR offices on July 4th, 1984 was in fact carried out by the JDL. And a local journalist wrote up an article about that aspect of the thing, because the circumstances of the firebombing of the IHR office in 1984 were never entirely clarified. In the aftermath of that, I tried to find out if it was possible to prosecute anyone, but I was told that the statute of limitations had long passed for that incident. But I did get access to the investigation records by the police department of Torrance, California, where the IHR offices were at the time, and was able to read in great detail how the police at the time even had pretty well nailed down the exactly how the firebombing took place and who did it, and confirmed, in fact, that it was the Irv Rubin and his group that had carried out that firebombing. In fact, Irv Rubin claimed, I think, he's been arrested more than 40 times. And however unpleasant his stay in prison was at the time he died, it's a miracle, or it's amazing, that he wasn't in jail many, many times before that and hadn't been convicted many times over for other crimes he's committed. Yes?
I believe you said that Nelson Mandela was supported by Amnesty International because it was politically correct to do so. Could you explain a little more about that? I mean, why, when there was so much violence involved there, why did they...
Well, because supporting a white minority regime in South Africa was very politically correct, and virtually the entire world media was supportive or was opposed to the white government of South Africa and was supportive of Nelson Mandela and the African National Congress that he represented. And so it was very popular, easy to support Nelson Mandela. Yes?
The attorney who represented Zundo during the Zundo trial in Canada, I believe his name is Christie, is he involved at all?
Doug Christie has been was involved for a while. This is a question probably you should ask Ingrid more than me. He was involved for a time in part of the defense case since his arrest in 2003, but especially in recent months, he's had some very pressing family problems that have made it impossible for him to be involved. But more than that, there's a lot of problems logistically. Doug Christie lives in British Columbia. Ernst and his whole case was taking place in Ontario or in the United States. But that's a question really to direct to Ingrid. Yes?
Just a quick question, getting back to the trial, which we're also concerned about the fate of Ernst Sundell. How was it? You were on the stand for 5 days.
Right.
What happened? Was it a travesty of justice, or were was the other side too persuasive?
No.
Can you sum that up?
Right. Yeah, that's
how
good.
Did you lose the trial?
Thank you. Good question. Very good question. Ernst Sundell was convicted in 1985 for violating the so-called false news law. An appeal court decided that there were several violations of justice by the judge in the case. False instructions or wrong instructions to the jury, and so that's why the second trial took place in 1988. At the end of that trial, also a jury trial, the jury found him guilty. The case then went to an appeals court and ended all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada. Eventually, the Supreme Court of Canada, in a 5-4 decision, or just whatever, one vote making a difference, ruled that the law under which Ernst Sundell had been convicted was unconstitutional. It's a very vague law. The Supreme Court effectively upheld the legal arguments that had been made throughout the trial by Doug Christie and by the Sundell side in the case. This is one of the tremendous ironies of that. As a result of that, this law was stricken from the books in Canada. And Ernst Sundell, as Bill Dunphy and others have said, deserves really the gratitude of everyone in Canada for increasing everyone's freedom in Canada and for removing a law that was a bad law in the first place. Now, I want to add something more than that. That did not stop, though, the intense hatred of the Jewish groups against Ernst Sundell. They didn't say, oh, well, thanks, Mr. Sundell, for getting rid of this bad law. No, the spirit of revenge against Ernst Sundell was tremendous. I was very, very struck by that when I testified in the so-called Human Rights Tribunal hearings in Toronto. There were attorneys there in that room from the Wiesenthal Center, Simon Wiesenthal Center, the League of Human Rights of B'nai B'rith, which is the Canadian counterpart of the ADL, the Canadian Jewish Congress. One particular lawyer, a guy named Rosen, representing the Wiesenthal Center, was particularly obnoxious. But the hatred of these people against Ernst Sundell was amazing to behold. They just will not rest with this guy. They want to destroy him. They want him put away forever. And the tremendous outrage is this. Ernst Sundell was brought before this tribunal because of material posted on the Sundell site, which Ernst Sundell doesn't even run and which is operated actually by Ingrid, at that time not his wife, now his wife, from the United States. The number one thing that was the object of complaint in these human rights tribunal hearings was the booklet, Did 6 Million Really Die? A booklet that's legal in Canada in printed form, and they wanted to put him in jail on the basis of a booklet in internet form, online form. It's an outrage just on the face of it, really, on a website that's based in the United States. That's another thing. I know Ernst Sundell, and I know he's about as technologically adept as I am. That is, not very much. And he's not the guy who put up that stuff. And although it's called the Zindel site, it contains a great deal of material that's not by Ernst Zindel. It contains a whole lot of other material, including, by the way, in this particular, in these hearings, material, and that's why I testified, material by me that's posted on that site. But it was a real eye-opening experience for me to see just how intense the hatred is. And this is a point I stress over and over again. Ernst Zindel isn't in prison because his views are unpopular. A lot of views are unpopular. He's not in prison because he's a real threat to national security. He's in prison because Jewish Zionist groups want him in prison. They insist he be in prison. They want him put away and locked up forever. And it's their pressure, their insistence, that's behind this campaign against Ernst Zindel. If it was not for the role of these organizations, the Wiesenthal Center, the ADL and its counterpart in Canada, the Canadian Jewish Congress, nobody would care about Ernst Zindel. He'd be living quietly in Tennessee. He and Ingrid would be living quietly in Tennessee. And that is very important to emphasize, because we're not opposed merely, we're not merely in favor of freedom of speech. We are boldly against those who are the enemies of freedom of speech.